I was raised to believe that the Bible defines good and evil for us within its pages. But when we stop and examine this idea using the Bible, we discover something else. In the Garden of Eden, there were two trees, a tree that would bring life to all who ate of its fruit, and a tree that brought death. And it was the second tree, the tree that resulted in death, that contained the knowledge of good and evil. Have we been deceived by the serpent who is trying to get us to eat of the second tree? Is the Bible really trying to define good and evil for us? Let's take a step back. Let's run an experiment. Instead of seeking to define good and evil, let's instead ask the question of the trees. Let's attempt to define life and death, but to do so, we must first seek it out. So join us as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Hey everybody, welcome to the Derech Chai Experiment, the show where we engage in due diligence in deciphering the specifics of what the Bible has to say about the people and events that it tells us about. The Book of Judges, it tells the story of several individuals who are given the task of acting as deliverer for the people of Israel once they repented of their rebellion and called out to God for deliverance from the enemies that oppressed them. But what is a judge? Is it a person who settles legal disputes and describes guilt and innocence in court cases? Not in this book, and not always in the Bible. You see, justice of this sort was not accomplished by a person who was sitting in a courtroom. That's a Western ideal. Justice in matters of disputes were settled in the gates of the city by the elders of a city who would judge on various matters. We find allusions to this practice throughout the Old Testament in various places, such as when Abraham sought to purchase the cave of Machpelah as a burial site for Sarah. He went through the entire process of offer, negotiation, and then purchase of the cave at the city gates. Later, in Genesis 34, Shechem and Hamor convinced the men of Shechem to be circumcised at the gates of the city. When Moses returned from Mount Sinai to find the people worshipping at the images of the calf, he went to the gates of the camp and cried, "Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me." When the son was found who was stubborn and rebellious, he was to be brought to the elders of the city at the gates to be tried. In fact, throughout Deuteronomy, matters of justice were always described as happening at the gates of the city. I don't believe that this is because there's anything special about gates. Rather, this is because this was the cultural place where judgment and justice occurred. Because everyone goes through the gates, and so if you need judgment, you know exactly where to go. But in the book of Judges, a judge was not a person who acted in a courtroom capacity by settling disputes and prescribing legal outcomes. A judge in the book of Judges is a person who brings about justice for Israel by defeating their enemies. We saw this clearly in chapter 2, in Judges 2:16. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them. This was the purpose of the judge, not to settle disputes, not to declare punishment or compensation for crimes committed, to act as the sword of God in bringing justice to the enemies of Israel who had enslaved and subjugated them and treated them harshly. So why do I bring this up? Well, it's because there is a common misconception that's nearly ubiquitous when it comes to the events related in this chapter. It is one that I have, in fact, propagated myself in the past, that is, until I really started to read the chapter very closely. So let's read this chapter together, and as we do, ask yourself this question. Who is the judge that is described in this chapter, and how does that change our own perspective of what's going on in this chapter? Judges chapter 4. And when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the eyes of Adonai. Therefore Adonai sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who was dwelling in Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried out to Adonai because he had 900 chariots of iron, and for 20 years he harshly oppressed the children of Israel. And Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, was judging Israel at that time. And she was dwelling under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. And she sat and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not Adonai, God of Israel, commanded, Go, and you shall draw towards Mount Tabor, and shall take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. And I shall draw unto you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots, and his company at the Wadi Kishon, and shall give them into your hand?" And Barak said to her, If you go with me, then I shall go. But if you do not go with me, I do not go. And she said, I certainly go with you, only there shall be no honor for you in the journey you are taking, for Adonai is going to sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. So Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and he went up, 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. And Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moshe, had separated himself from the Kenites, and had pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Sa'anaim, which is beside Kadesh. And they reported to Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera called all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from Haroset Higoim to the Wadi Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, Rise up, for this is the day which Adonai has given Sisera into your hand. Has not Adonai gone out before you? And Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men after him. And Adonai destroyed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera leaped from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Haroshet Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not one was left. Sisera, meanwhile, had fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber, the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, Turn aside, my master, turn aside to me, and do not fear. So he turned aside and went with her into the tent, and she covered him with a blanket. And he said to her, Please give me water to drink, for I am thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, Stand at the door of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and asks you and says, Is there a man here? You shall say no. But Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into the side of his head, and it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and exhausted, and he died. And see, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, Come, let me show you the man whom you are seeking. And when he went into the tent, there lay Sisera dead with the peg in the side of his head. And on that day God humbled Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had cut off Jabin, king of Canaan. Those of you who have listened to me for any length of time, you know that I am fascinated with literary patterns that occur in the Bible. So much so that I've dedicated a part of my life to exploring these structures and making them accessible to the world at large. But when I teach, I don't directly teach the patterns that are presented in a chapter, because the patterns are not the thing that's being imparted by the text. The pattern is simply the tool that helps us to discern better what's going on in any given passage. So while I do consult the various patterns of any given text and will highlight them when the pattern does seem to be what the text is getting at, or when the pattern can help us to get to what the text is getting at, then generally they're not my main focus. Well, with the book of Judges, this has been a bit different. From the beginning of book, there has been a pattern that's been laid out explicitly, and which we then saw developed twice in chapter 3. The pattern of sin that has been our focus for the last few weeks. Rebellion, release, enslavement, repentance, appointment, deliverance, and the passing of time. And this chapter, it begins with that usual refrain that we should be familiar with as part of this pattern. Time passed and the previous judge passed away, and the people of Israel once again did evil in the sight of Adonai, and so God sold them into the hands of their enemies, and the children of Israel cried out to Adonai. And the next step should be obvious. God appoints a judge to deliver Israel. And what do we read as we come to that point in this chapter? Deborah, a prophetess, sat judging under a tree in the midst of the land. And this is where the pattern that's been established can help us to make sense of what's happening here. Was Deborah appointed by God to be a judge? Well, it says here that she is judging. But does that mean that she is Judge Judy sitting over courtroom proceedings? No, that's not what judging means. Instead, it seems as if, in this moment of crisis, the people cried out to God, and Deborah, as a prophetess, went to this place to relate the judgment that God had decided on in the case that had been brought before him by the people. And the solution, the judgment that God gives, is to appoint a new judge. I contend that Deborah is not the judge of chapter 4 and that she is not the judge of Israel at this time, at least not in the way that this book speaks of and uses the term judge. Instead, I believe that Barak is the judge of this day, and Deborah is the prophetess that God uses to appoint him as judge. Now, this is probably rather controversial to you, but I believe the New Testament agrees with this assessment. Let's turn to the New Testament for a second and see where the judges are addressed. Hebrews 11, in fact, is a chapter that we're all probably pretty familiar with. It's the Hall of Heroes of the Faith in the New Testament, recounting the deeds of some of the great people in the Old Testament that were accomplished because of their faith. Well, near the end of this chapter, the author stops with specifics and just throws out a list of other names that could also be spoken of as heroes of the faith, and this is what it has to say. Hebrews 11:32. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets. The author lists the names of several judges and King David. Gideon, Samson, and Jephthah we'll read of later in the book as judges. So why does the author of Hebrews use the name Barak instead of Deborah? It can't be because of patriarchy, because the author of Hebrews gives credit to Sarah and Rahab before getting to this final summation of the characters of the faith. Could it be that Barak was the actual judge that was chosen to deliver Israel? Could it be that we give honor to Deborah and Jael rather than to Barak because of the prophecy that Deborah gave? The road on which you are going will not lead to your glory? Deborah is not the judge in this story in the way that those that we consider judges have been portrayed. Deborah and Jael get the glory, but Barak is considered the savior, as even the author of Hebrews states. So how does this shift our thinking? Well, the only real implications of this that I can think of are in the egalitarian versus complementarian versus patriarchy debate. If Deborah was not actually acting in the role of judge either in a legal sense or in a military sense, but rather in a prophetic sense, well, then a huge support of the egalitarian position crumbles away. And so this recognition is important, if for nothing else, than better understanding the roles of men and women as described in the Bible. Another thing that we read of that should pique our attention is found in verse 3. Why is it that Israel cried out to Adonai? The number one reason given was that Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. This was a huge tactical advantage at the time, since Israel was still in the Bronze Age, and the nations around them had entered into the Iron Age. This means that Israel's armor would have been nearly useless against harder weapons, and their weapons would have been nearly useless at piercing the enemy's armor. Israel was at the bottom of the stack this whole time, and now you add iron chariots to the mix? Not just wooden chariots that could be stopped with bronze weapon, iron chariots that would become nearly unstoppable. In fact, it was because of the iron chariots of the Canaanites that Judah stopped in their conquest of their inheritance of Canaan. Judges chapter 1, verse 19, and Adonai was with Judah, so they took possession of the mountains, but they were unable to drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. Judah was unable to drive out the inhabitants of the plains in their land because their opposition had the technological advantage of chariots of iron. And now, several generations later, an enemy gains the upper hand on Israel and is able to hold it for 20 years because of their iron chariots. And because God sold Israel into his hand, but we'll get to that. Regardless, the iron chariots, they are a huge deal for Israel. But this insight, it raises another question later in the chapter, so let's continue. Once Barak is appointed, he goes out, he raises an army of 10,000 men strong, and they meet Sisera at the Wadi Kishon. Now, this location is important because it is in this mention of the Wadi Kishon that we find the hook that allows us to better understand what happens next. During the battle, it says in verse 15 that the Lord routed Sisera and his chariots from before Israel, and that Sisera ended up fleeing from his chariot. How could Israel have possibly routed men in iron chariots? These iron chariots would have been the equivalent of tanks in World War I. Second, why in the world would Sisera leave his iron chariot? Why do you get out of a tank when there are only poorly armed infantry surrounding you? A chariot is faster than men on foot. It provides a higher position than the men on the ground. What could drive you to make such a drastic move and give up a strategic advantage? Well, I think that we are told why, not in this chapter, but in the following chapter. In Judges chapter 5, we're going to read the song of Deborah and Barak. In the song, they make mention of something that seems to explain how God routed Sisera. Judges 5:21. The torrent Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon, march on my soul with might. The torrent of Kishon. So what is Kishon? Well, Kishon is in fact a river that always seems to have a small amount of water in it. But the word used in Judges and elsewhere to describe this river is a wadi. So what is a wadi? Well, a wadi is a riverbed that is usually dry in the dry months, but which can then flash flood and turn into a raging torrent in a matter of moments when rain occurs. The rains don't even have to occur in the place of the flooding. It can happen anywhere upstream. This can make a wadi extremely dangerous as it can flood without warning on a clear day. And if we turn earlier in the song of the next chapter, we read this in verse 4 of Judges chapter 5. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the region of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. Yes, the clouds dropped water. What is verse talking about? Seir and Edom, they're synonymous in the biblical literature. At the time of the judges, Seir was far to the south and the east of Canaan. But Mount Tabor and the Kishon Valley, they are much further north into the west of Canaan. Well, I'm not going to go into it this week, as this is found in the next chapter, but I will summarize real quick. What seems to be referenced here is that the armies of Sisera gathered in the Jezreel Valley that houses the Kishon River. As Israel drew near to fight, a rainstorm that occurred elsewhere in the land caused the wadi to flood, thus nullifying the iron chariots and making them useless. In fact, more than useless, they became a liability. So Sisera fled his chariot because it could no longer move. Its advantage was completely taken away in mud and water. And so Adonai routed Sisera before Israel. And as Sisera was forced to escape on foot, he encounters a woman who offers him a place of hiding from Israel, a place of supposed safety. So who is this woman that invites Sisera in and then betrays him? She is a descendant of Moses' father-in-law of the Kenite people that settled in the south. Heber, the husband of Jael, had at some point made peace with the Canaanites and had moved away from his own people, presumably to be closer to his Canaanite allies. Jael would have been a friendly face for Sisera. It's highly likely that Sisera even knew her, or at least knew of her, because of her husband. Sisera was the commander of Jabin's armies, after all, and Heber was an ally and was at peace with Jabin. It would have been his duty to know who was friend and who was foe as the commander of the army. Sisera likely believed that he had escaped harm by going into the tent of this friendly party. Alas for Sisera, Jael was, for whatever reason, no ally. Again, we're not told Jael's reason for killing Sisera, only that she did. Now, there have been all sorts of speculation on this, but I hesitate to bring any of it up, since the speculation covers a huge range of ideas and motivations and that aren't even hinted at in the Bible. Except for her lineage. This is the only potential clue that we are given, is that she belonged to the family that descended from Moses' father-in-law. Regardless, once the deed is done, Jael runs out to the passing army, flags down Barak, and leads him to the corpse of Sisera in her tent. Barak then proceeds to lead the armies of Israel against Jabin in an extended campaign, and they are eventually able to completely drive him from the land. Once again in this chapter, when we identify the right person, we find the cycle of sin recounted once again. But the cycle does not end until the end of the next chapter, when 40 years pass after the events that are recounted in this chapter. But what else can we learn from this chapter besides the cycle of sin and who the judge was? Well, this lesson is not limited to this chapter in the book of Judges. Rather, it is a lesson that permeates the book from one end to the other. But since there are multiple lessons that stretch from end to end in this book, I'm going to take this week to examine the lesson of not trusting our senses when it comes to obeying God's command. We will see this come up again in the story of Gideon and even in the narrative of Jephthah, but we'll focus on another lesson in that story. Judah looked with their eyes and were unable to drive the enemy out of the valley who had iron chariots in chapter 1. The enemy had an overwhelming tactical and technological advantage that could not be overcome. Sisera looked with his eyes and thought himself invincible in his iron chariot. Again, the tactical advantage was his. These backward Israelites, they are no better than barbarians without technology and with only one god. Easy prey for an army with technological and theological superiority. Then Sisera looked with his eyes and he identified an ally with which to find shelter once his chariot had given up on him. And this is a move that cost him his life, as the wife of his ally was not as allied as her husband seems to have been. Even Barak looked with his eyes and he saw a woman who was favored by God and insisted that she accompany him on the campaign in order to assure his victory. His faith was not in God so much as it was in God's mouthpiece. And because of this, he lost his rightful place as judge, as it had been taken by several women. He lost the honor that should have been given to him. Deborah is called out as judging, and Jael is credited with being the means of salvation. The things that should have been Barak's were given to women. In the ancient Near East, this was an ultimate shame. And this is the lesson. When God gives instructions to do a thing, looking at the situation with your eyes will lead to a less than desirable outcome. It might be something as little as permanent shame in the eyes of the world, or as large as the enemy getting the upper hand and ultimate subjugation. Because the fact of the matter is that the enemy will look with his eyes as well, and because of this, the enemy will fall prey to God's plans. We have only to obey God when he commands, and, as the old soldier proverb says, it is not ours to question why, it is ours to do or die. Or in this case, it might be more accurate, if not quite as eloquent, to say, it is not ours to question why, or even how, it is ours to do and or die. We are people with allegiance to our God. That is what faith means. And because of our allegiance, it is simply our duty to carry out what God instructs us to do, regardless of the personal consequences. And in keeping our duty and obeying God's commands for our lives, we can find life. So Derech Chai, seek life in all that you do. Shalom. Thank you for tuning in to Derech Chai. If this content has blessed you and you would like more, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, and sharing with others. To find out more about what we do and to support this ministry, head over to seeklifesc.com. That's seeklifesc.com. We'll see you again next time as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Shalom.